The Dillons were interesting people. They were, first and foremost, humanitarians. At a time when there were problems with racial relations in town, the Dillons opened their home to people who were unable to find homes, who were working in the community and who were going to school at ISNU. But their main source of support was the Percherons. These are huge Norman draft horses, the kinds with the hairy feet and the long manes. And what they did here in town was to start a nationwide and indeed international line of Percherons.
How prevalent was the need for such workhorses in their era?
One of the things about the Dillons, they went back to Europe once a year about to purchase horses for their line, but their greatest horse was Old Louis Napoleon. This horse sired over 400 colts during the 20 years he flourished. And he was famous the world over, and they had businesses with anywhere from Canada to Mexico, and even people from foreign countries came here to buy these magnificent workhorses. They were the engines that pulled the plows and pulled the buses and the trucks and stuff of those days.
What made a Percheron better than a Morgan?
I wish I knew enough about it to tell you, except that these Percherons were such magnificent beasts that they also were great for show. They were so impressive that, and there are other horses that could slog along and work, but these magnificent beasts were something to see in their own right.
The Dillons are also memorialized in an apartment complex right now. Is that where their farm used to be?
It really was, Charlie, yeah. The Dillon stables have been remodeled, and they had a big fire there a couple of years ago, and they owned all that land on that side of the railroad.
So just off uptown.
Yeah.
And Judy, you mentioned race relations. How did they play a part in the town's development there?
Well, what they did, Charlie, was to bring these students who had no other place to live, provided them with a loving home, and they would not tolerate prejudice.
You know, Martha died in 1910, just before the beginning of the First World War. As a part of the influx of people from the South, workers, uneducated people who were coming up here for jobs, they brought with them their value system, and it became a time of increased segregation in the North, and the Ku Klux Klan became an immensely powerful organization in the states of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, the industrial belt of the North.
The Ku Klux Klan in Bloomington Normal in McLean County focused not just on African Americans, but on immigrants and Catholics as well. And this was also a key time where many immigrants from Europe were coming in.
Exactly.
But getting back to race relations, there was a time before that there was a substantial black middle class in town, and you're also chronicling that.
It was interesting that the woman that we have representing the black people in the community, Julia Duff, very interesting story because graduated in 1915. Well, she left the university in 1915 before she received her final degree, but she came from a very strong family with a long tradition in Bloomington Normal, and they were middle-class people of good standing.
Her father, Peter Duff, came to Normal along with Jesse Fell.
He came with Jesse and worked for Jesse for a while, but he was very well thought of, and the family was well thought of. They were part of this established middle-class black community that existed in this town, but which was gradually being eroded by these new forces coming in, reinstating segregation and the attitudes of the poorer South that had been imported into this area. And the Dillons fought against that. Poor Julia Duff had to leave the town. She couldn't find a job in 1915. She ended up
in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just 2 years before the Tulsa race riots.
She was in
and
that.
And she got caught up in that. Newly discovered material about her allowed us to revise her script. We incorporated her words recounting her experiences.
There were roving bands of marauders who were in that time in the streets. They started the riot. And they came right into the house where she was living, and they took the owner of the house she was renting from out into the streets and made him give up all of his own belongings. And they demanded that Julia leave without her baggage or suitcases, and Julia refused to do it. She claimed it was out of nervousness, but she was just a staunch lady. And so finally they let her take her things, and she went out, and they burned all those houses. Almost all of the black middle-class people homes in Tulsa were destroyed. It's astonishing what they did. It was one of the worst race riots in the American history.
What did she study when she was at ISNU?
She studied what we would call home economics. It's interesting because she was a follower of Booker T. Washington. And during her period of teaching, William Du Bois became the ascendant figure in the African-American community. The idea any kind of work can be done with dignity and with pride. And of course, the opposite of that was you only went after jobs that were worthy of you, that demanded that you stand up for yourself and say, I'm worth more than this. So she was a woman on the cusp of changing attitudes.
How important was this split between the assertive Du Bois mindset and the accommodationist Washington mindset in the African-American population of the U.S.?
It grew and grew and grew. By the time we get to the 1960s and 70s, we see a total split. And the assertiveness that went with Martin Luther King against the Black Pride people, with Malcolm X and SNCC, these people were on the cusp of yet another change, another shift in attitude.
And it took the form of the Black Panthers, of course, in 1970. And during that period, the leader of the Black Panthers, Jerry Hampton, but his friend and bodyguard was Mark Clark, who was a former ISU student, and they were both essentially assassinated by a band of riot police in Chicago right in December of 69, just before in May of 70, the Kent State happened, and all of this was boiling in unrest across the campuses all across the country. And many of them went into riots and stuff. And ISU was one school that didn't blow up, but it seemed so close to doing so. And we tell one of the stories of that in our story of the near riot.
Tell us about that.
At that time, the president was Samuel Braden, who was a remarkable guy, really. There was a lot of unrest on campus because of the Black Panther incident in Chicago and because of the assassination of Malcolm X, a black leader at the time. And the black student group on campus demanded that the flag be lowered at half-mast in honor of that. And also, after the death of the students in
Kent State,
the emotion was ramped up terrifically. So Braden agreed to lower the flag for 6 days to honor all of those people, but he also agreed to lower the flag for one day on May 19th, the birthday of Malcolm X. And this was the day that when the hard hats who were working on the new library at ISU saw that the flag had been lowered to half staff, they came on campus in the morning, raised the flag back up to full mast, and then a student climbed up the pole and they had fixed it so he couldn't get it down. And he got up there, unloosed it, and brought it back down to half staff. And then the hard hats announced that they were going to come back at noon on the lunch hour, and they were going to raise the flag for good. At that time, the students were gathering on the campus. The black student organization was in front on the west side of campus in front of the gymnasium with
you have
sticks
a powder
with
keg.
Chains on it. And, yeah, it was terrible.
How did Braden finesse that?
That's a really interesting story, and we'll tell you all about that. When we, and it was a remarkable thing that either he or Newbold, the chief of police at ISU at that time, thought up, but it saved the day, and we're going to tell that story.
And John Kirk was there.
I happen to have been there, so I participated in history at that point.
Okay. Please do give a brief snippet of what happened to give the audience a reason to come.
At noon, when the tension was building, the white hats were all gathered at the end of the campus where the overbridge is now, ready to come on. Suddenly, we heard the sound of a huge engine revving, and there appeared between Cook Hall and the theater this huge truck and came slowly revving up. The crowd parted and went for the flagpole and started a transition that eventually saved the day.
John Kirk and Judy Brown are with the Illinois Voices Theater Project and Voices from the Past, performing as part of the Normal 150 celebration. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.